Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Performance-Based Contracts conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Ms. O'Brien, you may begin the conference.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. My name is Mary O'Brien, and on behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, I want to welcome you to today's call on performance-based contracts, making deals with providers. Around the country, child welfare agencies are focusing on outcomes, safety, permanency, and well-being. And as they do that, many agencies are trying to work more with critical partners who have an impact on those outcomes. In many systems, contracted providers delivering services are one of those crucial partners. We get a lot of inquiries at the Resource Center about developing performance-based contracts or what agencies are doing to get these partners, these providers, more on board. Over the years, we've gathered and provided information on different approaches agencies are using. Today, we are going to talk about one of these approaches, and I wanted to start by putting today's presentations in a broader context. I want to say first that there are a number of handouts for today's call. These handouts were sent as attachments in an email to the person who registered for the call, but I want to let you know that they are also posted on our website. I'm going to give you that address now in case you're at a computer or you want to access the handouts. It's nrcoi.org. That's the National Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, nrcoi.org. If you look under teleconferences June 6, the handouts will be there. I prepared a handout called Strategies and Resources, which describes different approaches to improving outcomes specifically for children in out-of-home care. Many agencies are using a combination of these approaches. For each approach, the handout gives some examples and some resources, including previous teleconferences we've offered. One approach is to specify outcomes in contracts and to increase monitoring of those outcomes. Another approach being used and often explored in system of care sites is to redeploy deep end funds being used for kids in residential care or in psychiatric hospitalization from across systems to an entity that provides wraparound community-based services. And a third approach is building financial incentives into contracts. And we're going to talk today about one approach of, you know, one example of that approach. As I say, for all three of these approaches that I mentioned, the handout that I gave has some resources and some examples so you can kind of look at the broader context. I'm really excited about today's call, and we're going to hear about one approach to making deals with providers. We have with us Mike Shaver, who is the former Deputy Director for Budget, Research, and Planning from the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. When he worked in that role, he was involved in developing and implementing the performance-based contracting approach being used in Illinois. I've had questions over the years about the Illinois approach and how possible it is to replicate it in other places. So I've been pleased to see that Philadelphia has had some success with this same approach. And so it will be great to hear from them today. We have with us Danielle Ray, who's a project manager with the Best Practices Institute in Philadelphia, to talk with us about their experience. I mentioned handouts for today's call, the strategies and resources one I put together. There's also a file with contact information for the presenters. So if you want to follow up with either Mike Shaver or Danielle Ray or the Resource Center, the contact information is in that handout. Mike prepared a paper about the lessons learned in the Illinois approach that he has shared on our website, and he also has prepared a PowerPoint for today's presentation that, is, as I say, was in your email and your on the website. And Danielle has also prepared a PowerPoint. Those are the handouts we have for today's call. Before we begin, I just wanted to mention a couple logistics. We do have a large number of people registered for today's call, over 30 states and several of our ACF regional offices. So we want to welcome you all to the call, and we're really glad that you're all here. Because of the large number of registrants we've had, we're We are going to keep the lines closed during the presentations to keep the background noise to a minimum so you can hear what's being said. But we will open the lines up for questions in between presentations and at the end of the call. So I think what I'll do now is ask the operator, Pam, if you would open the lines now, I can ask if people have any questions or any questions that they would like to see Mike or Danielle address that you'd like to bring up at the beginning of the call. So, Pam, okay. Are you able to do that?
Yes, all lines are open.
Okay, great. So does anyone have any questions or any questions for the presenters before we begin?
This is Charlene Bobo from the District of Columbia.
Yes.
I have one question. I think it's prime. Well, it's for either presenter about how they were able to, but how they were able to accomplish the contracts that they did within public procurement rules about competition and so forth. It sounds as though, at least in Illinois, they continued with their existing pool. We're planning for performance-based contracting in the district and are really trying to figure out how to ensure that procurement rules, standard procurement rules, are not an obstacle.
Excellent. Excellent. That's great. Maybe Mike and Danielle can just make a note of that, and when they're talking, you know, either address it or add it on to what they were going to say.
Be fine. Thank you.
Great. Anyone else? Okay, that's great. Well, we'll open the lines again after each presentation for questions. And, Pam, you can close them now so we can make sure that we can hear Mike. And I will have asked Mike Shaver from Illinois to begin.
Great.
Okay,
and
all lines are closed.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mary. It's a pleasure to do this. I really do appreciate the opportunity to kind of talk in a less formal setting about what we were doing and what we have done in Illinois. When Mary first approached me about doing this, I told her that, you know, despite the fact that I had done countless presentations talking about the Illinois model and the Illinois experience, that the kinds of specific questions that were being asked about, well, when do you think about whether or not it's the right thing for us? And, you know, can it apply to any set of service conditions you would like to improve in your system? That actually turned out to be a much more difficult process. So what I've tried to do here is with both the paper as well as the presentation, is frame the discussion this way. I mean, in Illinois, we had a certain set of problems that were systemic problems that we needed a way to address. And performance contracting and a particular application of performance contracting that relied on provider-oriented incentives was the best approach to our set of system problems and doing it within our sort of unique constraints. But one of the things that I have noticed increasingly is as performance contracting has become part of a real common in the child welfare lexicon is that different people mean different things when they say performance contracting. So I really tried to construct a discussion that talked about sort of the basics, that frames it in terms of the problems that we needed to address in Illinois and Chicago in particular, and then go through and illustrate sort of at different steps of our own process why we utilized the model that we utilized. Now, it's probably not a surprise to recognize that I am a pretty aggressive advocate in the market approach that I think that the Illinois model incorporates. And I know in a lot of social service sectors, market can be, or market forces can be kind of a new concept, a foreign concept, and even a dirty word. But I want to sort of go through and sort of illustrate like what I think makes the model differently, and in particular try and contrast it with what I think is a perfectly acceptable, important line of work that exists elsewhere. That is the push towards accountability. But I think it's important to understand that at least from the framework that is the Illinois model, it's different. It's tackling a different set of problems. So with that preamble, let me just begin. Now, I think it's always good to start with the results because, I mean, from my vantage point, when I worked in state government, and you guys know this well, you know, you go to countless presentations, and the question is always, well, like, how does this help me? How does this solve some of the problems that we face right now? So I think it's good to start with the results. Through uniquely performance contracting in Illinois, we were able to see increases in permanency through adoption. We were able to see increases in permanency through subsidized guardianship, and I recognize for a lot of jurisdictions on the call today, that's not an option, but it's an important option because in Illinois we secured a federal 4U waiver that allowed us to be able to provide, send kids home and guardianship and continue to provide a subsidy for those children with the Fed supporting it. But we saw significant numbers there, though not nearly as high as the numbers in adoption. And then most important, we recognized never before seen reductions in the size of substitute care population. So that's a rough shot of the big results. Now, if you go to the third page labeled the permanent explosion, you can sort of see exactly the kinds of numbers that we're talking about, and you can sort of see the history around this. You can see that prior to performance contracting being implemented in 1997, an adoption or a permanency rate, all combined, reunification and adoption, that hovered just below 5%. You can see after, within a year of the implementation of performance contracting, you see that permanency rate jump to 20% if you follow the dotted line. And in terms of raw numbers, you see permanencies that go from roughly 2,000 kids a year to 8,000, 9,000, and at our peak, 9,000. Kids a year. And if you want the actual numbers, if you look to the chart to the right of the mountain, you can sort of see from fiscal year 92 through the projected number of permanencies in 07 what that's looked like. Now, it is not, performance has not declined dramatically in Illinois. Obviously, Illinois has run out of eligible kids, or not run out of all eligible kids, but has seen a significant drop in the caseload, and that, of course, is going to drive the raw numbers that you see. But you see that permanency rate after peaking has just been pretty consistent at roughly 15%. Most of the performance came out of Cook County, and that's Chicago. And if you go to the next slide, you can see that most of the results were really driven by adoption. You know, and that's where the opportunity, the unique opportunity for Illinois lay. And so you can see both in terms of raw numbers represented by axis on the left-hand side of the chart, you can see that, you know, again, in terms of adoptions, below 1,000 kids, or just roughly 1,000 kids in 97 and 98, it more than doubles. In 99, it continues to decline. And then if you just look at the rate based on a percentage in care, you can see that permanency rate, that adoption rate, went from, you know, roughly 5% and peaked at 12%. That's just the adoption rate. The rate that we talked about in the previous page, that was all permanencies, and that's why you saw it was a higher number. That's how it was able to get up to 20%. Big question people have when they ask about the results, they say, wow, you moved a lot of kids to permanency. Did all these market-based incentives cause people to game the system so that they were sending kids to permanent settings, but that those settings, those permanencies really wouldn't be viable and they wouldn't last because everybody was worried about the implications of not performing? The next chart, Cook County's record on reentries, tells that story. It looks at cohort data, meaning for each fiscal year listed at the bottom, that's the year that a particular cohort of kids would have gone to permanency. And if you start at fiscal year 93, for all the kids that went to permanency in fiscal year 93, there were 200 disruptions. And then if you look at that squiggly line that runs through it, the axis on the far right tells you what percentage of all of the permanencies that went to permanency in that fiscal year, what percentage that number of disruptions actually constituted. And you can see that starting in 97, despite the fact that we had significantly more kids that went to permanency in fiscal year 97, the actual number of disruptions remained about the same. The reentries remained about the same, the blue being the adoption ruptures and the red being the reunification ruptures. But you can see that as a percentage, it dropped dramatically, and that's because we were sending more and more kids to this subsidy class, and about the same numbers as historically had disrupted continued to disrupt. So it's funny because we, in Illinois, we got hit with a really funny newspaper article just before the administration change that said, wow, 5 years ago, only roughly 200 kids were disrupting out of adoptive placements back into the system. Now it's closer to 300. What's going on? Why did it increase? And what we couldn't get anybody to understand is that as you grow the number of children in the subsidy class or in the permanency class, you would expect, if nothing changed, the numbers of kids that disrupted and came back in the system would actually grow, because if the rate stays the same against a growing base, that number is going to increase. But we actually kept trying to explain to people that it wasn't a rush to permanency, that as a percentage of all the kids that went to permanency in a particular year, fewer and fewer of those permanencies were rupturing. In other words, they were stable permanency. So that's the highlights of the results. The last slide is the drop in the substitute care. And that's, you can see, we went from a peak in 97 of slightly more than 50,000 kids in care, and that the end of fiscal year 07 projection is 17,000. So an acute drop in substitute care, mostly driven by permanencies. So that's the why. Why performance contracting? Because it can fundamentally change performance. The real question is, like, what are the keys? Why would you think about performance contracting as opposed to simply a set of provisions that would be designed to hold providers accountable? Everyone has the challenge of ensuring that the money they spend, taxpayer money, is spent in a way that's designed to secure the best results for kids. But what's different, I think, about performance contracting are like a couple of things, and I just sort of identified these as keys. The first of these keys is that I think performance goals should be linked to larger system objectives. I see lots of jurisdictions sort of struggling with various questions around improved performance, but they're struggling in the context of maybe a program improvement plan as a result of the Children and Family Services Review, so they have a specific target there, or there's a mandate that's come out of the General Assembly that says, boy, you know, we ought to do a better job of returning kids home. And while these kinds of performance improvements are important and organizations should pay attention to them, oftentimes they're not put in context of a larger set of system goals. For example, asking the question, should we increase the numbers of kids that are returned home? Some folks evaluate that and say, look, I just want to see the number of kids that get reunified increase. But they fail to look at the front door of the system and ask whether or not the front door of a particular system is really tight, meaning that the cases that come in the system to be served are cases where there's a less than fair prognosis for reunification. Different child welfare jurisdictions have different rates at which they remove kids and place them into care. Oftentimes you see those jurisdictions with high reunification rates are those jurisdictions that actually have high removal rates. So simply saying, hey, we want to improve reunification rates doesn't put the performance goal in the context of a larger system objective. So I think it's really important if you're going to think about performance contracting that you're saying, what do we want for the system? Do we think we have an opportunity to reduce the length of stay? I think this idea can also be tied to other areas of performance, and Mary highlighted some of those at the beginning of the conference call. Is there an opportunity to decrease the rate at which children are removed from the home? You know, and there are a number of folks out there, whether it's the University of California at Berkeley that has a database, the Child Welfare League, you can always start by saying, well, where do we fit in the context of other systems? And is there an opportunity to improve performance here? Is there a larger system objective? Another area would be asking the question, do we utilize high-end placements at a rate that should be reduced? Are we too quick to move kids into a therapeutic or a residential program or a congregate care setting when that kid's behavior isn't manageable in the foster care setting? I mean, that could be constructed and framed as a larger system goal. It's not just saying we want fewer kids to enter residential care. It's saying we think that we could do a better job of stabilizing placement. And that's where the performance contracting question should start, in the context of a larger system objective. It's not just we ought to get more adoptions because everybody's getting adoptions. It's asking the question, do we have an opportunity here? Is there a system inefficiency that can be addressed? The second point, and I think it's an important point, is to move beyond having just the accountability conversation. It's not just a checklist of saying, have you done the right kinds of things? Are you safely providing for children in their homes? Do you have a track record at securing permanency? It's moving beyond the accountability conversation, because oftentimes I look at performance contracts that are addendums to contracts that list 10 or 15 outcome expectations, sometimes with thresholds and benchmarks, other times without. Sometimes it's a set of outcomes, and then there's a caveat at the top that says every provider will improve their performance in the following areas by 10%. And yet nobody even knows what their baseline is. Nobody really even knows what they're going to manage to. That's what I mean when I talk about the importance of moving beyond the accountability framework and knowing whether it really is a set of specific performance indicators you want to drive, or is it simply saying, you know, this is our threshold for contracting and we hold people accountable because, you know, that's what we're interested in. Both processes are important, but I think when you're talking about performance-based contracting, you've got to move beyond that conversation. The next issue is that, and it's an important one, and often gets left on the bargaining table or in the planning room in state or local government, and that's that you link outcomes and provider incentives. And obviously, when we talk about performance contracting, there's an assumption that we're talking about the relationship of government with private providers. But there are also ways to think about similar models, even if it's one entity of government entering in a relationship with other, or central administration with local offices. But the important thing is that the outcomes that you seek have to be in line with the incentives of a clear set of incentives with those you charge with delivering on the results. If you leave that in the planning process, it's very difficult to expect that people will operate against their own interests, or that they'll take seriously something where the benefit to them is not tangible or not realizable, and that's important. And the last thing, and it's an important thing, and you don't really think about it until the time comes to make a set of decisions about the results of performance. And that's the benefits of performing and the consequences for not performing should be self-enforcing. If what has to happen at the end of the day is that some administrator in a room has to look at everybody's results and say, these guys stay, these guys go, then you don't have a self-enforcing system. And that's largely because the incentives are missing. So a successful model will make sure that the benefits of performing and the consequence of failing to perform are self-enforcing. That is, that it's not an administrative action that actually has to act on it, because that's where the all-familiar tensions around political discussions can play out, and that's where the level playing field and the transparency can get lost, particularly when you're talking about performance with consequences. So those are some of the keys. Now let's talk a little bit about how we applied all of these keys in Illinois. The primary objective in Illinois that we faced was a system that was out of control. The caseloads had accelerated in a very short period of time, and the primary objective for the director of DCFS, and there's a little more history in the paper, was to right-size the system. We knew we had a system that had far more kids in care on a per capita basis than any other jurisdiction in the country. And the question was, now that most of that was privatized, how did we get that out of that runaway growth back under control? Now, the key factors underlying that rapid runaway growth was a couple of high-profile media cases, one that landed us in the New York Times and then a couple in the Chicago Tribune. They were the Keystone Kids. They were, it was videotape of large sibling groups of kids that were left in, absolutely atrocious, in squalor-like conditions that generated, like, a lot of attention. And there was a reason for it. Our front end was overwhelmed. We didn't have investigators where we needed investigators. We didn't have people who could make a consistent set of decisions about removals. And when that hit the press and all the negative attention that followed, what happened to us happens in a lot of other jurisdictions. Folks started taking an approach that said, look, if I'm in doubt about what's going on in this home, I'm going to remove the kid. Compounding this dynamic was a very irrational kinship care policy or relative caregiver policy, which essentially removed and would place in the system any kid that was living with a relative as long as we could verify that there wasn't a biological parent on the scene. It had nothing to do with child safety. So it was an irrational policy that we had to look at, and of course, obviously, we had to fix the front end. Well, Illinois was able to do that, and you could see that starting in 95, the foster care panic that sort of created the growth from 91 to 95. This is in the next slide. I'm sorry. I'm hoping you guys are staying with me. But if you go to the substitute care caseload and you look at the green and blue mountain, you can see that there was this period of rapid growth, which was the combination of an irrational relative care policy, coupled with in 94 and 95 the media cases that really contributed to acute growth, and then you see that it kind of stabilized. And starting in 95 and 96, even though there was growth from 95 to 96 and from 96 to 97. The growth was not nearly as acute as it had been. And we realized something at that point. And actually, if you look at the total caseload, the set of numbers on the side, you sort of see rapid growth starting in 92, 28,000 to 33. You know, you see the growth, 47 to 50,000. And then you see, so you see the slowdown there, and then you see 50,000 to 50,007. And what we noticed was that, okay, we had stemmed the growth, but we weren't getting smaller. We weren't right-sizing. We were moving kids out of the system at about the rate that we were moving kids into the system. So even though we had done a great deal to clean up the front door, we were not any closer to our primary system goal, system objective, of right-sizing the child welfare system. Obviously, this was a problem because if you go to the next page, the uncontrolled growth, those problems were still not solved. We had a runaway budget. We continued to have a loss of public trust because we were the largest state-administered system in the country. We had rapid privatization and without much accountability. And we had pressures at every level of the system. So accountability for us was not going to work because we were just in the process of getting that stuff under control, but we still had this primary challenge of right-sizing the system. That's why if you go to the next slide, moving beyond accountability, we had, even though acceptable performance for us was that we had controlled the front door, we now had a heavily privatized caseload that was basically stagnant. We were no closer to right-sizing it because we saw that everybody was just maintaining caseload size. That's when we started to think very differently about the contracts, because it seemed to us that we had a set of providers that it's not as though there was some complicated conspiracy to keep kids in care who didn't need to be in care. But the providers basically said, look, if I start the year operating a program for 300 kids, that's basically how I think about my management objectives. That's basically how I think about, you know, how I stage the work over the course of a fiscal year, which is I need to have an infrastructure designed to serve 300 kids. This made it very difficult for us on the government side to get anyone's attention on the permanency prospects. That is, people could talk about, oh, sure, we think there are lots of kids on our caseload that could be moved to adoption. The problem was, even after repeated conversations, we saw that the pattern continued. People moved kids out at about the rate that they moved kids in. And that's because agencies were working in their own interest, which was maintaining an infrastructure that would allow them to serve a particular number of kids. That's when we started to think differently. And that's where we started thinking through a set of contract expectations that would take advantage of the flow model, the idea that everybody wants to manage a particular manage against a particular infrastructure. And so for us, we wanted to think up a contract structure where the consequences would be self-enforcing. And that was where we began playing around with the idea of the model, which I'll get to in a second. Now let me just stop here for a minute and talk about what's important about engaging providers, because I want to clarify that when I say we, I'm actually talking about the public and private sectors. I mean, it really is a joint operation. And engaging the providers is a real important part of this process, because it is, I have certainly seen a number of models that are developed, redeveloped, worked, and reworked by a set of central planners in government and then sort of unleashed on private providers. I think that those models often meet with limited success, because there are lots of things that at the central level of government that we don't understand about private sector service provision, and I think there is a fair amount that the private sector doesn't understand about resource limitation, et cetera, with government. The only way you begin to bridge those gaps and have a real conversation is to get get both the public and private sector to the table to talk. Now, what do you want to be ready with when you have that conversation? It begins and ends with data, good information. I mean, that's how you begin to think about what opportunities, what inefficiencies exist in the system that you can act on. And a second piece is an appreciation for the systemic barriers to improve performance. I mean, oftentimes the analysis never goes any farther than saying, well, we're not doing well because nobody wants to take doing well seriously. Oftentimes the bureaucracy, history, a way of doing the work can be its own barrier to improve performance, and you've got to be willing to have a conversation about what those barriers are. Is it the way contracts are currently structured? Is it how the work is siloed and how the work is divided up? Unless you're willing to sort of put everything on the table that could have a potential impact on your desired area of performance improvement, it's going to be tough to think about and structure contracts that can address it. The next item is a willingness to realign resources for better performance. Now, this is an important one because, again, I have either read about or worked with state and local authorities who want a great deal in terms of performance improvements, but they come to the table and say, sorry, we have nothing, we have no money. You know, whatever you do, you have to do with the existing resources that you have. And often, you know, it's not to say that, I mean, everybody understands that government resources are always constrained. But if government isn't willing to come to the table and think differently about how those resources are organized and how the resources are aligned across contracts, oftentimes it's unfair to come to the table and expect better performance. At the end of the day, the process can certainly be a budget-neutral process, maybe a budget-neutral process because you can capture the savings, but an unwillingness to talk about organizing resources differently can often break down your ability to actually put a viable plan on the table for providers. And the last thing, and this is an important thing, and it's probably intuitive, but you know, if you don't have in this dynamic dialogue between providers and government decision-making authority, then it can be very difficult to have robust discussions that actually turn into an agreement that folks can be enthusiastic about. So those are just some of the important things to bring to the table. I'm going to sort of quickly go through the objectives. You know, obviously we were interested in reducing the number of children in substitute care. We were also interested in stability, reducing the movement of children from costly placements, from foster care to more costly placements. So we wanted to improve stability. And then the last piece is we really wanted to do this, but we wanted to make sure that we had provider incentives and the outcomes on the same page, not just an addendum in the contract, but actually on the same page. We had a couple of barriers, and they're barriers not unlike the question from the District of Columbia. We had a current way in which we contracted for services and the way we financed for services, and that had a tendency to emphasize process over results. We also had caseloads that we had to deal with. And we had a contracting structure that had separated all the adoption work from the rest of foster care. So we had adoption contracts that sort of paid for adoptions on speculation. But it was hard to think about improving adoption performance if you had a separate set of contracts out there for doing that. So that was a barrier. We certainly had a resource question. How are we going to provide more money to reunify families? We had historically not provided very much for providers to do that, and that was one of the barriers. This issue of access to counseling resources. Every time a private provider needed to access counseling resources, they'd have to come to the state, and we'd have to approve it on a case-by-case basis. And a lot of providers continued to say, I can't make the progress I need to make in a case if I'm stalled for 3 weeks waiting for a government approval process. And then finally, resources to actually recruit homes. In terms of the priorities, we've the same things that I've actually been talking about. How do you create a contract that focuses on results and not process? How do you invest in a contract that ensures that it's not just a checklist your providers are managing, but they're managing towards a set of outcomes? One of the things that the providers brought to the table is they say, we think we can manage to these outcomes, but there has to be a conversation about how you create flexibility in doing that so that, again, it's not managing a to-do list. You want this on the 30th day of placement. You want this on the 45th day of placement. But rather, you take your priorities around performance. You put those in those contracts, and you allow us to move towards those outcomes. This is an important one. We knew that we had to fund enhancements, but we designed a financing structure that will become a little more clear when we actually talk about the model that actually allowed us to fund enhancements upfront, lower caseloads, counseling resources, by essentially locking in performance targets that would create and generate savings in the back end. We knew that if we met our performance targets, we would not spend what our projected trend line in foster care costs would be because the system would begin to right size. We'd begin to see fewer kids in the system at the end of the year than were there at the beginning of the year. So we could capture that savings up front and invest it in some of the program enhancements. And finally, the important thing is if you're taking these resources from savings that you expect to accrue by the end of the year through improved performance, you have to shift the risk of not meeting the performance targets from the government or the state, wherein if you provide all the money up front and then they don't meet the target, then what you end up with at the end of the year is a more expensive program and more kids to serve in that program. That risk had to shift from government to providers. And that was the key to using financial principles, using incentives, and using, you know, pressures around risk and the notion of enterprise risk to shift all the risk of failing to perform from the state back to the provider. And that's how we were able to ensure budget neutrality. So let me just talk about what the model was that did this. As I said, when we recognized in the beginning that providers really managed a core infrastructure, child welfare services are really about human capital. Supervisors, direct workers, case aides, that's how the work gets done. There's a component of it that represents auxiliary services, but mostly what you're paying for in contracts when you've got privatized foster care services is you're paying for a basic infrastructure. Now, what providers brought to the table in the negotiations with us was that it was very difficult for them to get aggressive about moving kids to permanency because it could take bites out of their infrastructure. If they were trying to manage a caseload of 100 kids and they moved 30 kids to permanency by the end of the year, then their challenge would be, what do we do about the 30% WAC by the end of the year that we take in our program if you don't get us new referrals? So that's when we started to think about using the flow and using the basic infrastructure of the foster care agencies to run this process. So we started thinking about organizing our services around the caseload. And for every caseload of then 25 to 1, the caseload is much lower in Illinois, but at the time we started, we had 25 kids. We were paying for 25 kids, and we were paying for one worker for every 25 kids. And what we knew that we could control, or at least predict, was the entries into the system. We knew how many kids came into the system the previous year. We could model that, and we could allocate those entries across our Chicago providers. Now, what we asked our providers to do was to manage the back end, to manage towards our permanency target for the first year, which was 24%, and to manage to the non-permanency target or instability target, which was no more than 8%. So we would refer cases in. The job of the private agency was to ensure by the end of the year that they would manage the exits so that at least 6 kids would exit to permanency and no more than 2 kids would leave to a higher level of care or bounce from the contract. What we agreed to do in exchange for this basic structure was pay for a base rate for 25 cases the entire year, that we would fund the infrastructure associated with the 25 cases in relative care. By the way, BARC stood for at that time, for budgeted allocation for relative care. It's no longer this model of utilization-based reimbursement, a per diem for every kid for every day that kid is in a placement. Instead, on the administrative side, we decided to say we will pay for a budgeted allocation for relative care, one worker, 1/7 of a supervisor, 15% administrative overhead, and that's your basic funding. We will ensure a flow of at least 8 referrals over the course of the year spread out across your program for every caseload that you have, and your job is simply to manage the back end. 2 clear objectives: manage for permanencies and limit the non-permanencies. We had a similar arrangement for regular care, except we called it the budgeted allocation for traditional care. And again, it was we would manage the intake side, and their job was to manage the exit side. This riveted the attention of our provider community to ensuring that they were managing the back end, because suddenly they realized that if they exceeded the permanency mark, if they sent 30% of their kids to permanency as opposed to 24% of their kids to permanency, that they could hold on to the infrastructure. They would not actually be reduced in size because we were always going to fund them based upon that core allocation for regular foster care and for kinship care. And that the job of providers was essentially to ensure that they met or exceeded the permanency mark and that they did not exceed the non-permanency threshold. So we were finally managing around a dynamic process, managing around flow, ensuring that it was self-enforcing, because if you fell short on the permanencies, you'd still have the same number of kids coming into your program. You didn't move enough of the children to permanency as we're called for in the contract. So at the end of the year, your funded caseload might go from 25 to 1 to 26 or 27 to 1, depending on how far below the mark. Now, we were not going to reimburse agencies for those extra kids. Our only guarantee was that we would make sure that no agency was managing so many kids that it would undermine or put at risk their service capacity. So we would just come and remove kids from their caseload and then cut their contract and reallocate those cases to performing providers. So the question is, now that you have providers sort of riveted on these two objectives in the back end, what was the impact with respect to the entry and exit of cases at a provider level? If you go to the slide that's home of relative care trend in Cook County, you can sort of see what our historic problem was when we grew. The blue line represents the total caseload, and the left-hand column shows you the thousands of kids that we had in care, and this is just Cook County relative care. So at our peak, Cook County relative care was about 24,000 kids. You can see what happened, that on the red line, which indicates the number of kids coming into the system, that when that red line is above the green line, we grew. And then you see what happened at about September of 95. The number of kids coming into the system, when it would drop, the number of kids leaving the system, the green line, would also drop. When the number of kids would come into the system would increase, the number of kids that would leave the system would increase. We realized that what this really was in Cook County was providers just managing to their capacity. No provider was interested in uncontrolled growth, so when they got five or six kids more than they could handle, suddenly they would look differently at permanency options. And that would sort of drive that performance during the period of increased intake. And then you can see that that trend, as long as it was going to continue, we were never going to get right-sized. The turnaround for our system in relative care and then in regular care, which you can see on the next page, where the green line crosses the red line, came in March of 97 when we announced performance contracting and told people that they would get credit for that last quarter of the fiscal year. And you can see that that's the first time that the green line, and dating back to September 89, that's the first time that the exits from foster care exceeded the number of entries, and it was all driven by permanency. And there was finally, we had removed the disincentive for providers to move, to act on their potential around permanency by telling them that irrespective of how many kids they moved to permanency, we would continue to fund their same infrastructure by organizing and paying for a set of paying for capacity. as opposed to actually kid count, that their only job was to at least meet the target and, it, whenever possible, exceed that target. And you can see that the impact on the caseload was profound. It took a little longer. Performance contracting in regular care was implemented a year after performance contracting in relative care, so it took a little longer. But again, you see the same thing. That's how we knew that performance contracting was really the thing that was driving performance as opposed to other dynamics in the system, because the staged differences in performance occurred at two different times for two different contracts, and they both had the common characteristic of corresponding with the implementation of performance contracting. Now, the model is explained in much more detail in the paper, but I think there are just a couple of things that, again, I want to go back and reemphasize. The first is that we were managing towards a much larger system goal, right-sizing the system. And if you're thinking about a performance contracting, you need to think about what your primary system goals are and whether or not there's a way for you to add an engine to those goals in the form of performance contracting. I think you can see that the second thing that we looked at that was important was that it wasn't just accountability. Like, we could have consistently said, look, we want to make sure you guys are doing all the work you're supposed to do, and folks could have continued moving kids out of the system at about the rate that they were coming into the system. We had to get management to focus, management in the private sector, to focus on unrealized opportunities, and that meant moving beyond simple accountability as articulated in a contact structure. Accountability is always an important thing, but it's not going to be an engine that can drive major reforms in and of itself, because you have to think of the third point, and that's outcomes and provider incentives being aligned. It doesn't make sense to have a provider community, to have a system that's managing towards a set of outcomes that ultimately undermine their best interest. There has to be some sense of trying to figure out a way to say, these are the outcomes we want, and these are the benefits of meeting those outcomes. Because when those incentives are aligned, it's amazing what people begin to pay attention to, and that's an important piece. And the last piece, again, is you can see by the way we structured these contracts that someone failing to meet their permanency target in the very first year would be managing slightly higher caseloads. That is, it was a self-enforcing rate reduction. The same amount of money would now be paying for fewer kids. Or we would come in and say, look, we have to get you guys back down to 25-1 because that's what the contract calls for, so we're going to downsize. You're going to lose a quarter of your capacity. The important point is it was self-enforcing. We didn't wait for a year's worth of performance data to collect and then sit and rank everyone and then say, okay, now we need to go out and make a series of decisions about the guys that are at the bottom of the list. The benefits of performance were self-reinforcing. That is, you could reduce your caseload, you could enhance your rate, and the consequences for failing to perform were self-reinforcing. You would lose rate. You would lose lower caseloads if you didn't meet the targets. And that's a very different proposition than looking at a bunch of performance data at the end of the year and then saying, okay, these guys have to get reduced by this amount, these guys have to go away entirely, because that's the kind of activity that generally can paralyze government in terms of making decisions, and it's largely because of all the transactions costs associated with eliminating providers or cutting, and there's also the politics that get in the way. So I'm happy to answer questions. I hope this was clear, and if you do have additional questions, there's contact information for me on the contact sheet as well as the last page of the presentation.
Excellent. Michael, thank you so much. This is Mary. This was a very excellent and clear overview, I think, of that approach. Pam, maybe we'll open the lines and we'll just take a question or two. I do want to start with Danielle Ray from Philadelphia soon, so we make sure to hear from that perspective, which I think will be a really interesting follow-up. But at the moment, I think the lines are open. Okay. Pam?
Yes, all lines are open.
Okay, so does anybody have any questions for Mike?
Yeah, this is Joan Gilmore in Cincinnati.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, it seems like with this kind of a reduction, eventually even your good performers would have to have their caseload sides reduced.
Well, you know, the benefit of this particular model is that the caseloads could, like, I'm going to speak from a provider perspective, okay? If I continued to have, you know, good performance or beat the mark, my caseloads could get smaller and smaller and smaller every year. But the important thing was I had a contract with the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services to have, let's say I had five caseloads, to have five workers, you know, one supervisor, and a management infrastructure. Even though my caseloads were getting smaller as a consequence of my excellent performance, my infrastructure would remain untouched. I would just go from ratios of 25 to 1 to ratios of 15 to 1, which is where Chicago providers are right now.
Okay.
Now, the important there's an important point, though, that I think you're getting at, and that's we did have an issue where as the system was contracting, we knew that we had way more capacity out there than we really had need for. So the benefit of our model, the performance contracting model, is that we could – the good providers could get lower caseloads. And then we could use the fact that we didn't have enough cases coming into the system to fill everyone out, and we could use performance to downsize and shrink and in a number of cases eliminate those providers who weren't performing. And that's where the system was reduced.
Okay.
Every year, you know, we would put folks on hold, and that's how we were able to manage that system.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Great. You know what, Mike? I'm sure there's lots of questions. It was such a really thought-provoking presentation. Let's go on now to Danielle, because
sure.
I want to make sure to hear from Philadelphia, and I think folks on the line would probably like to hear that, and that will give us a good chunk of time afterwards for questions for both jurisdictions, which might provide some other perspectives on questions people already have.
Right.
So, Pam, I'll ask you to close the lines, and Danielle, I can turn it over to you.
Okay, all lines are closed.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Mary. Thanks for this opportunity to share Philadelphia's experience with performance-based contracting. Philadelphia's had really great results with implementing performance-based contracting for foster care services. And when I use the term foster care, I mean also what Mike referred to as home of relative care. We call it here kinship care. Performance-based contracting was implemented in March 2003. There were 27 agencies involved and approximately 4,200 children. Philadelphia County accounts for approximately 50% of Pennsylvania's child welfare system. So anything that we do affects the state-administered system to a great degree. If you go on to the PowerPoint, what you'll see, the first slide is permanency and accountability. So I want to make the point to everyone that implementing performance-based contracting in Philadelphia was part of a larger permanency strategy based on evaluations of Philadelphia's child welfare system and day-to-day practice. It was clear that Philadelphia needed a new strategy for achieving permanency for children. So performance-based contracting was implemented. Permanent legal custodianship was established as a permanency option. There were a number of other permanency reforms, including close collaboration with family court, work with lawyers from the city and family advocates, including child advocates and parent advocates. Performance-based contracting also allowed the department to manage system resources more effectively. So in terms of referral, you know, in the past, agencies were more specific about who they were able to serve. Agencies had no consequence for not taking children. And, you know, in terms of the leadership's ability to manage referral and referral data, you know, how many referrals do we have in the system? Who are they going to? You know, what happens after they go there? There was not a capacity to manage resources at a systemic level. Additionally, aftercare was implemented, which creates a continuity of care for families and, again, allows management of resources from a more systemic level. And looking at why, in particular, the performance-based contracting model was implemented here in Philadelphia, you'll see on the next slide things that were appealing about the model to leaders here. PBC promotes permanency and stability, as Mike Shaver was saying, by setting explicit performance expectations. So based on your contract size, you know exactly how many permanencies an agency is expected to achieve in a year. Increasing resources and flexibility to achieve those expectations, and realigning contracts to link what we want for children in care with what we pay for. So instead of paying for days of care, it's a way of incentivizing permanency and managing referral according to the needs of the system, as I said. I think some of these things I think I can kind of go quickly on because I think Mike gave us a lot of valuable background information. And know that the system in Philadelphia is, while the exact numbers may be slightly different, the principles are the same. So how he discussed the caseload structure is the same here in Philadelphia. So if you look at the next slide, permanency and stability, this will show you some of our results. So the green bar is our permanencies. So you'll see a dramatic increase in number of permanencies from FY02 to FY03. Remember, late in FY03 is when PBC was implemented, FY04, our first full year of performance contracting, and FY05. So based on the number of children in care going down and the number of permanencies going up, this is actually an 84% increase in the permanency rate between FY02 and FY05. The orange bars are the instability. So Mike talked about this a little too, moves up to higher levels of care. We also look at transfers to other agencies. So these went down dramatically. So a 50% decrease in instability, which is maybe more helpful to look at as a 50% increase in stability. Our next slide refers to returns to care. So again, what Mike was saying, you know, are these sort of good, safe, stable permanencies, or are we potentially creating a system where agencies have an incentive to move children to permanency maybe before they're ready? So we measure returns to care to make sure that agencies and DHS are making good permanency decisions and moving children to safe and stable permanencies. So you will see that the percentage of children returning to care within a year after their permanency has gone down dramatically. So starting at 10% in FY02, so the white bars in the front are all permanencies. So of all permanencies, we're looking at a 10% return rate to FY04, which is our last full year of data, of 5%. The green bars in the back are reunification. So as many of you probably know, reunifications are more likely to break down than PLCs. So we did want to represent that the rate of reunifications breaking down is slightly higher than other permanency options, but it still went down significantly. We also see on our next slide that length of stay decreased significantly. So for foster care, on July 1st, 2002, of children in care, the average length of stay in foster care was 44 months. On July 1st, 2005, the average length of stay was 34 months. For kinship care, the average length of stay also decreased significantly from 33 months to 27 months. Want to kind of briefly talk about, you know, what are some of the things that were different about PBC. So there was, you know, collecting all of this data, gave us a great ability to talk to providers about their performance, about, you know, potential concerns, potential improvements, and really just opening up a lot of communication back and forth, which, you know, enabled us to address what the barriers were. So implementing PBC did create a lot more communication between the public and the private sectors. We have a steering committee. We have work groups for referral and for aftercare. So here we iron out some of the day-to-day practice concerns that come up. We've had some joint training efforts around permanency and aftercare. So providers and public sector workers have been trained together so that everyone is working with the same goals. So we found that really clarifying, you know, what the goals were, you know, establishing that public and private sectors were working with the same goals and establishing who was going to do what, so really clarifying, you know, whose responsibility specific things were, all were really important pieces of this collaboration with the private sector. I think I didn't really get into too many more specifics on the model here because I knew that, that Mike was going to give us illustrations. So I think if we can go to questions now if anyone has them.
Great. Thank you, Danielle. Pam, you can open the line for everybody to ask questions. We'll put the lines open again.
Okay, all lines are open.
Great. Thank you.
And Mary, just before the questions, I mean,
sure.
It's probably worth highlighting, because I know I didn't talk about it much, that, you know, obviously, as Danielle would tell you, the Illinois folks worked with Philadelphia, you know, and we continue the same folks that were involved in performance contracting in Illinois, particularly Joe Loftus, who's the director of the youth campus and runs the Chicago Center for Child Welfare Policy. I mean, we sort of work with them around their own dynamics. Philly has, in many ways, a much more sophisticated model, better data, better information. But we started, as Danielle highlighted, at the same place, which is what is the opportunity and how do we get sort of folks thinking about that. So it's not that we sort of randomly stepped in two similar directions. We've been working pretty closely together for a while.
Absolutely. That's great. Would either of you want to address the question from D.C. about the procurement rules and how that played out when you were putting these contracts in place?
You know, you're absolutely right to point out that it's a little different in Illinois because obviously we had a bunch of foster care contracts on the street. And so it wasn't as though we were going to privatize and start like a new set of services. But I would simply, you know, tell you this, and I will tell you I don't know very much about the regulatory framework around procurement in D.C. But, you know, we all have them. We certainly had them at the state government level in Illinois, and even sort of with these contracts being out on the street already, there were certainly all the procurement issues. That is a problem with the solution, sort of independent of thinking through what it is you want at the end of the day. In other words, I mean, there are administrative hoops to jump through, but whatever those hoops and however you think through sort of your procurement challenges, the challenge that you're going to face, or the fundamental challenge around what you want and what you pay for, that's going to remain the same. And I think that the thing that I would advise is that you do a quick scan to make sure that the procurement regs don't sort of lock you into multi-year contracts, for example, that they don't lock you into utilization, that they don't lock you into adjusting or guaranteeing anything that you feel might undermine your ability to answer the fundamental question, what are my outcomes and how do I incentivize those outcomes so that I align them. So I would say that that's probably the most important thing to do, is to do the scan to see whether or not there are going to be tensions between those two objectives.
great. Are there other questions for either Mike or Danielle at this point? This is a good time to follow up with questions.
Hi, this is Tennessee.
Hi.
Hi. My name is Harriet. When you talked about the providers that fell short of the benchmark,
yes,
meant serving more children,
yep,
without a change in the contract level.
Yep.
Didn't cost the state anymore.
Nope.
And the agency had to provide for more children without a rate increase.
Yep.
But what happened to the quality of care for more children?
A very good question. I was afraid I was going to have to start calling you Tennessee, Harriet.
Oh.
That's a really good question. First of all, the contract was very specific about saying that if an agency ever fell short of its performance so that its caseloads increased by 20% or more, that the department reserved the right to come in and do across-the-board program adjustments to realign their caseload size. We knew that prior to performance contracting that we were adequately, not ideally, but that we were adequately managing with caseloads of 30 to 1. That's basically what they were prior to performance contracting. So we knew that even if we set that threshold at 25 or at 20%, that the most we'd ever let a ratio get to would be 27 to 1. And we did have one agency that experienced that. And what we did is we simply said, look, here was your performance target. Here's where you guys wound up. Here's the gap between where you should have been and where you were. Here's the resulting number of kids on your caseload right now that technically we're not paying for. That is, here's the degree to which your rate has just eroded. Now, we were able with those agencies to negotiate essentially a no-cost for us, for the government, reduction in their contract capacity. That is, when they were looking at managing caseloads of 27 to 1, or going back and managing caseloads of 25 to 1, they were willing to give up a quarter of their contract capacity. And we would literally transfer those cases and redistribute them to the performing providers. Now, the benefit of that is that we were in a decline mode. That means, we were not having as many children entering the system, and we, in fact, did not have enough children entering the system to even fully obligate all of the contracts. So when we reached a provider that was at that level, we were able to say, look, right now you're contracted to serve 1,000 kids. You really have closer to 1,200 kids sitting on your caseload right now. And what we would like to do would be to come in and transfer 300 kids off of your caseload, redistribute those to the rest of the system. And they were willing to take us up on that. They were willing to say, hey, look, at least we can do a planful reduction in our capacity, because the contracting structure was capacity-based. So they could say, we'll give up four caseloads, and we'll have a staged way in which we do it. We can have a structured way in which we do it, and we'll be ready to start the following year as a smaller but hopefully leaner operation. So that's how we really managed the guys that we were worried about failing to perform, causing consequences in terms of the remaining cases on the caseload. And it actually worked well. And let me tell you, as someone that sort of spent a lot of time sitting across from these agencies, the power of a performance contract in helping an agency executive director see that it was in their best interest to reduce their capacity by 25%, as opposed to coming in and saying, hey, you guys didn't do well compared to everybody else, so we're going to transfer 25% of your cases. It was like night and day. I mean, it was a very different kind of conversation, and something that wouldn't have been possible given the previous framework that we used.
Thank you very much.
Are there other questions out there?
I have a question. This is Marcia in Montana.
Hi, Marcia.
Could do this in an urban setting where you have an ample supply of contracts? Have you given thought to how to do that in a, or have you experienced trying to do this in a rural area where if you cut back, there's a scarcity of people then to place the clients with?
Marcia, I mean, that's a very encouraging question because it shows me that you actually, that I actually managed to be clear about what the model entails. You're absolutely right. It's very different in an urban setting compared to a rural setting. And the big difference is in an urban setting like Chicago or Philadelphia, you have providers that are good substitutes for each other, right? If one doesn't perform, you can turn to another one and say, you didn't perform, you're getting smaller. You guys did perform, you're getting bigger, or you're staying the same size. We implemented performance contracting downstate. Now, it's a different model. It's a little more, I'm sorry, when I say downstate in the Illinois context, I mean everything outside of Chicago, Cook County, Chicago. And we did run into some of the problems that I think you're talking about in Montana. That is, we would have some localities of our state, like in the middle western part of our state, where there was basically one provider, you know, and that was it. So what we did was kind of take a look at where there were natural concentrations of care. And then we had a structured conversation about very specific benchmarks and permanency, what we wanted people to manage toward. And then we created a preferred referral process based upon the providers that actually performed the best. We also developed a way to pay for each permanency in excess of a certain benchmark. Again, it was a uniform benchmark, so it became each permanency over the 24% benchmark, so that if an agency actually didn't get a referral to replace that kid because they were in an isolated part of the state, they would at least have some cash to support infrastructure if they didn't immediately get that referral. And then that allowed us a slightly longer longer time frame to continue to try and direct referrals whenever possible to those providers who were succeeding. Now, we weren't always successful. Sometimes we really did have isolated providers who were doing well, who were literally putting themselves out of business. But with performance contracting, at least we had a framework to have a conversation so that we could look at other alternatives, like maybe other service options, you know, expanding other programs. When we were doing a reduction in congregate care settings, we then turned to these top providers and said, look, you know, we're going to have kids that are coming out of congregate care facilities in Chicago that actually belong in these communities, and you're top on our list to get those referrals. So it is different. It's not a model that the Chicago model and the Philadelphia model would not be a perfect fit, but the same principles apply. That is, you know, the conversation's got to evolve beyond we want everyone to do better and to thinking about what outcomes you explicitly want and how you can link those outcomes to what the contract actually pays for and reinforces.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense, Mike. Thanks for that reply. Does anybody want to follow up on that? Okay, are other questions out there?
This is Montana again.
Yes.
I'm not saying that word is really helpful because if you don't have enough providers and you're moving them to other places, not only do we have the issue of isolated areas that don't have a lot of providers, now we're talking geography. I mean, you can drive 9 hours in one direction. You haven't left the state yet. And so depending on where some of those providers are located, you're talking about moving kids huge distances perhaps to these providers. And what I see is kind of a sense of Walmarting this to a certain extent, where it's one-stop shopping, and we have lots of different big providers doing things, but they may not be ideal or even located where we have the need. Does that make sense?
No, it does. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I mean, it does make sense. And I realize, again, having tried to sort of think through this in smaller rural communities in the rest of the state, it was a challenge that we always ran up against. So let me just suggest you, like, you maybe back up one step and first say, you know, have you guys thought through, like, where the performance opportunities in Montana lay? Where are the inefficiencies? Where do you guys know there's opportunity to do bigger? And then the second step is to say, okay, if we could close these gaps between, you know, where we are and where we want to be, this is what this system would look like. And then you start to you use that basic framework, and you start to look and look for, like, little pockets within the state where you can fit together your performance objectives and your contracting arrangements. There will be, because you're absolutely right, you don't schlep a kid from one end of the state to the other end of the state for the sake of someone having secured a set of outcomes on their contract. I mean, it is because your first priority will be to always serve the kid in the most appropriate context you can arrange for that child, that is going to be in tension with trying to do the work differently. And so that's why I try in the beginning to talk about, you know, the process. I mean, if you really think you can use a contract to shift performance around, you know, obviously a first and important question is to say, well, what's the degree of privatization for these services? And then after you answer the question about how they're privatized, where are your markets? Where do they exist? Where are your pockets? And then you begin to start, you know, piecing together what could be the elements, the elements of a strategy. You know, I know it's tough because we present one model, but I think the broader message here is that you can get better results if you think beyond sort of the conventional wisdom of, we'll attach an appendix to this contract that says we expect people to do good work. And then you start looking at, you know, where your providers are and how you can use that natural presence to get efficiencies and think about market forces as a way to drive that. There could be some areas where that just won't work, but I think what I would encourage is just that you think about it as a process, as opposed to saying, oh, that's an urban strategy, so it doesn't make a difference. Because we did eventually see gains, remarkable gains, in performance outside of Cook County, but it was an evolution of 3 years because we had to wrestle with location, not being able to honor, you know, our commitments for referral in some places, but it did drive the system.
Great, Mike, thank you. Are there other questions out there? I wonder, this is Mary, both of you might want to comment a little bit. I just think one of the main points here is this idea of reallocating existing resources and the idea of making a deal that, you know, you were able to fund some of the enhancements up front that were needed for services, dealing with the Illinois, the counseling, the recruitment resources, that kind of thing, with this sort of deal that providers were then going to be accountable for a permanency rate that would give you the savings that you needed to do that. A lot of times, I think people try to make it's important to try to make those deals about using the money differently. Do you want to just comment a little bit about that? I'm curious about how that worked in Philadelphia and, you know, your comments on that. Danielle, did you make those kinds of deals, would you say, where you made some investments in the system?
Absolutely. So, for instance, funding upfront a position that, and this was also part of the Illinois model, I believe, what we called a permanency worker. So a non-case-carrying staff that could be sort of a permanency consultant for the regular staff who maybe were so busy with home visits and putting services in place and things like that it was harder for them to strategize on permanency. We also built in emergency resources because prior to PBC, not all foster care providers had been able to do emergency same-day placements, but that was clearly a need of the department. So by building in some funding into the administrative rate, we said, okay, you know, you'll have some funding that you can use for, you know, however you want to design your emergency placement resource. But now, you know, we need everyone to be able to do this. And as a result, emergency shelter placements went down significantly. And it was a significant part of the Philadelphia model.
And as Danielle said, we went through a similar exercise in Illinois, which was just really about saying, okay, well, what are the resources that, that folks really think are necessary in order to sort of achieve these results? And so, as Danielle mentioned, I mean, in Philadelphia, as in Chicago, folks needed that capacity and adoption. But the exercise, again, the analytic exercise, was just to say, if we begin the contracting season by saying that there are 3,000 kids, just for example, that we know we serve at the beginning of the year, but we're contracting for an acceleration of permanency so that the number of kids by the end of that year is, say, 2,500, then how do we design a contracting structure that extracts the savings for that 500 kids by the end of the year, but we'll just annualize it to like 250, you know, cut in half. Can we think about using what we know is going to be a smaller investment in the foster care system up front, managed by making sure that you shrink the non-performers, and then take that to fund these enhancements up front? And that's what's so unique about this particular model, is that you have a lot of people who want to make major gains in improving performance, but they say, there's no money, so how can we even have the conversation? And that's often because the conversation has never gone to the level of thinking, where are the system opportunities? Like, what outcomes are we managing toward? Why are these important? And what would it mean for the system as a whole to perform here instead of where we are now? Turning that into a number, turning that in, figuring out what state, local, and federal resources are tied up in it. I mean, it's not a totally simple exercise. But then saying, if we did better here by this degree, and whether it's residential care you're talking about or foster care like we've been talking about, you can think about reallocating those resources up front. And it's a contract structure that's self-enforcing, like the performance-based contracting model, that allows you to guarantee that when you put all that money in the contract, if someone doesn't deliver on the outcomes, that you've got a mechanism that doesn't hold you accountable as the state, because you're not going to be paying additional money for someone's failure to provide. And it really is, I mean, and as I talked with Mary about, you know, how to structure this, it really is about a process. It really is about thinking about the opportunities that exist within your, you know, within your jurisdiction. And starting there, and then there are, you know, plenty of supports out there that you can draw on to help you, like, walk through the mechanical processes of how do we think about system savings and reinvestment? How do we think about the procurement process? How do we do an analysis of like, markets that exist in a statewide system like Montana? I mean, those are all sort of analytic questions that can be addressed and different options explored. Mm-hmm. But it's starting at that more fundamental level that really gets you there.
Absolutely. Listen, we're at the end of our time, so I'm going to need to wrap this up. I want to say thank you to Mike Shaver and Danielle Ray very much for being with us today and sharing this perspective on the experience in Illinois and Philadelphia. As Mike said at the beginning, he's definitely an advocate for this very powerful kind of strategy, and I thought it was important to get, it would be good to sort of share some of the you know, fundamental points of this strategy and sort of explore how applicable it is across the country. And I'm glad to have had these discussions about, you know, what context it can work and you know, and how some of the ideas that might be able to be applied in sort of non-urban areas. As I mentioned at the beginning of the call, there are different approaches to, you know, contracting, improving your outcomes in contracts, and we'll continue to explore different approaches at the Resource Center. We do have an evaluation form that was emailed to everyone, and it's also online, and we would be happy to have it. You know, if you could fill that out and send it back to us, we would appreciate any feedback in terms of this call and other calls you would be interested in you know, everything you'd be interested in having us explore or just feedback. We do use that in planning our calls. So please fill that out. I also want to let people know that these calls are recorded, so we create audio files of these calls. Within a few days, the audio file for this call will be on our website that I mentioned earlier, nrcoi.org. You can click on the audio file and listen to it. If you or somebody else who didn't get to participate would like to hear the call, you can hear it by accessing the audio file on our website. You can also request a CD-ROM version of the teleconference that we can mail you. You can write that on the evaluation form if you're interested in that. So, again, thank you to Michael and Danielle, and thank you, everyone, for coming. We'll hope to hear from you again in the future. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the conference. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.